You turn this morning to the matter of David's kingship. I laid the foundation last time for the domestic policies of his reign. We keep in mind the fact that the people of Israel, when they first asked Samuel to make them a king, they recognized that the king would have two major areas of responsibility. And so we read in 1 Samuel chapter 8 that they asked for a king, in 1 Samuel 8, verse 20, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. These are the two major areas of responsibility that a deliverer raised up by God, whom we conventionally call a judge, also had, and it was what they expected their king to do. And so it's not surprising that in 2 Samuel chapter 8, where we find a summary of David's reign, that it summarizes his military activities, how he went out and led Israel in battle and fought their battles for them, and how he also judged them. As we saw before in verse 15, that he executed judgment and justice to all his people, mishpat and tzedakah, or the sentence or letter of the law, mishpat, and establishment of equity, in the form of tzedakah. Tzedakah, of course, being righteousness, and that is appropriate because if something is truly equitable, it would be a righteous judgment. So there is a reason why the two words are connected by that common word of tzedakah. Last time I talked about the nature of these two things and the fact that tzedakah frequently involved either a greater severity than the letter of the law might have insisted upon, or, because of the circumstances of the case, there might be a weakening of the severity which the law might otherwise call for, and that the king or the judge before him always had to weigh these things, these very complicated decisions that weren't so cut and dried, in order that true equity would be presented. And I left the class with an assignment to read 2 Samuel chapter 13 about Amnon's rape of Tamar and the subsequent murder of Amnon by his half-brother Absalom. Absalom and Tamar were full brother and sister, and Amnon was only a half-brother. And then, of course, the follow-up with the widow woman who was a foil used by Joab to get David to see that he had grounds for weakening the penalty against Absalom. And then I also asked you to take a look at 2 Samuel 12, a very famous chapter, where God brings to David's attention his sin with Bathsheba by having Nathan, the prophet, come in as if he was bringing a real case. And it's not really something that happened. It's a parable. But David didn't know it was a parable. He thought it was a real case that his lower-ranking officials couldn't solve, and Nathan had somehow heard of it, and Nathan was bringing it to his attention for his judgment. And obviously there must be something about this case that bears on his own, otherwise there'd be no purpose in having designed the case in this fashion. And so I asked you to see what points of contact existed between Nathan's parable and David's sin with Bathsheba, and we can evaluate it from the point of view of Mishpat and Tzedakah. Okay, let's see what the class came up with in their busy weekend preparing for the Thanksgiving dance. Did they squeeze any time in on this, or did they let it go by the boards? Anybody want to volunteer, starting with 2 Samuel chapter 12? Or do we have total absence of fall on the matter? Mr. Gardner. Yes, if we look at first of all, we consider the parable as it was presented by Nathan. What crime was committed according to the parable? Not David's sin with Bathsheba, but the parable. What is the offense? John? Yeah, theft. And as Mr. Gardner correctly pointed out, the mishpat the letter of the law for theft is given here in verse 6 of 2 Samuel 12. He shall restore the lamb fourfold. But David did not just pronounce that particular sentence. What did David do besides saying that he should restore fourfold? Yeah. Verse 5 says the man who committed this crime should be put to death. That is not provided for in the written law of God. Deserves to die. In other words, it had to be put that way because the law did not require the death penalty for this crime. But in David's judgment, even though the mishpat only required restitution fourfold, the man nevertheless deserved the death penalty. Now, if this had been an actual case, that's the penalty that would have been imposed in addition to the fourfold restitution. That's where the element of tzedakah comes in. Remember, tzedakah can go either way. It can increase the severity of the punishment, or it can reduce it. Now, what were the grounds for David increasing it to such a mammoth degree? Because obviously there's a big difference between restoring something fourfold and the death penalty. I mean, what were David's grounds? Where did he see the reasoning that equity, demanded that severe penalty? Do you follow the reasoning? No?
The man who has taken the land has thousands of his own. Nearly ridiculous. Other man is just one land that the other man has probably had. He has thousands of his own. He can use for the meal of his family.
Right. Because of the extreme, as he says here, right, used to quote his own words, he says in verse 6, because he had no pity. Here was a lamb that meant everything in the world to the owner. And it wasn't just an animal to him. It was much more in his mind than just an animal. This thing was like a daughter or a son to him. It was a deep personal relationship that existed between the poor man and the lamb. He had raised it as if it had been a child. And he himself could so easily have provided abundantly for the wayfaring stranger out of what he had and never had missed it. And yet he hardened his heart to such a point that he took this man's possession, not just because he was poor, because God's law is very specific. God's law says, do not incline to the judges your heart towards a man in the judgment just because he's poor. That is not something to be weighed. You know, we frequently know that judges have to watch out. They don't twist judgment to favor the rich man. Well, God's law says don't do that too. But God's law also says don't favor the poor man simply because he's poor. But the operative thing here is that the only reason it's introduced that he's poor is to emphasize that this was his only possession. You see, to emphasize the uniqueness of that possession. And then it also explains, of course, that he grew up together with him and with his children, and eating of his own meat and drank of his own cup, lying in his bosom. It was like to him as a daughter. To show this intense personal relationship this man had been deprived of. And so, because the man did not give any consideration for the deep relationship involved and acted in such a heartless manner, he says, to achieve true equity, death must be the penalty in addition. Because if you sell this rich man with his thousands of animals, you've got to restore four to this poor man. He wouldn't even feel that. It's less than a proverbial slap on the wrist. He wouldn't even know those animals were gone from his flock. He would never know the day when the marshal, so to speak, came and took him away. Because he wouldn't have been looking out over his flocks. He couldn't see the difference. There would be no real sting in the penalty. And yet this man had shown such incredible hardness of heart. And so, because of that, he judged the man deserved death so that equity would be involved in it. Now, Nathan at that particular point, of course, tells David the bad news. You are that man. You have done likewise. You, with all of your many wives, coveted the one wife of another man. And you stole that man's wife. Now, out of your own mouth, you have pronounced the penalty that is appropriate in your own case. That you should restore fourfold, and you should suffer the death penalty. Notice what it says here. It's a sort of a parenthetical thing, but I'd like to at least mention it in verse 8. I gave you your master's house, meaning Saul's office, and your master's wives into your bosom. Many people aren't aware of the fact that when David became king, he inherited all of Saul's wives. They joined his already existing harem. Now, the reason for this is that in the Middle East, this is how it is publicly symbolized that a person has succeeded to the throne. He takes possession of his predecessor's harem. Doesn't mean he has to have relations with them necessarily, but they are his. It's a sign of a coming into royal power. And we need to keep that in mind when you stop to think about some other incidents that occurred. For instance, when Absalom later rebelled, one of the things that he did was to have sexual relations with David's wives that he left behind publicly so that everybody would know he had taken possession of his father's wives who had been left behind in Jerusalem. That was a way of saying, hey, I've taken over the kingship. See, the two things were understood as being inextricably linked. That's the reason why that was said. And that's why when God does pronounce his judgment upon David through Nathan, Nathan tells him, no, God will not demand the death penalty of you. He has sensed your true repentant attitude, and he will not require the penalty you've just pronounced out of your own mouth. He will set that aside. Of course, is God's prerogative. But, he says in verse 11, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house. In other words, rebellion out of his own house. And I will take your wives from before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. In other words, you committed adultery secretly, but this man shall do it publicly. Because the reason why it would be done publicly would be part of this revolution. This coup d'etat, you see, that Absalom would later instigate, be a sign to the people that he was acceding to the throne. Now, this is, of course, an example where the penalty was greatly heightened, and though God did demand a death, he did demand that the fruit of this adulterous union be the penalty. And then again, I think this is one of the most instructive moments of David's life, because we know, and I shouldn't pass by without making some comment upon it, even though it's tangential to the subject of today, and that is that David fasted day and night, prayed day and night, asking God not to take the life of his son. And yet, when he perceived that the child was dead, much to the surprise of his officials, he arose, he washed, he changed his raiment, and he requested food. They couldn't figure this thing out. Why does he act in this fashion after he hears the child is dead? But you see, this is part of David's attitude. He would ask for God's mercy. He would pray and supplicate God fervently. But once God rendered the decision, he accepted it. He didn't fight it. He did not continue to mope and complain about, and with bitterness about the lack of righteousness of God. He accepted God's decisions completely. And he resumed the course of his life. Now, it didn't mean he didn't grieve for his son. He was still grieving, but at least he accepted the fact that God had heard his prayers, and yet God had still decided to persevere and do what he had said he was going to do. And that the ways of God are always just. And therefore he accepted them. Now, let's take a look at the matter in 2 Samuel chapter 14. It seems easier to relate the parable of Nathan to the situation of David and Bathsheba. It seems a lot more difficult to relate this heart-rending tale of the widow woman to David's problem with Absalom. We back up to the last verse in chapter 13. It tells us that, remember, Absalom, after he had murdered his son, his brother, his half-brother Amnon, as a revenge for the way Amnon had treated Tamar, he fled the country. He fled to his maternal grandfather's kingdom of Geshur, because his mother was one of those foreign princesses that David had married as a way of forming a diplomatic alliance, and he fled to his maternal grandfather's kingdom of Geshur. But then it says in verse 39 of chapter 13 that the soul of King David longed to go forth to Absalom, because he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. In other words, he grieved for Amnon, but there was nothing more he could do about it. I mean, he was dead. He couldn't bring him back. And so now he was concerned about his living son, Absalom, his favorite, who was alienated from him, living in exile in Geshur. And the question comes up, well, then why doesn't he just say, hey, Absalom, come home, it's forgiven, if he really longed after Absalom? Well, you see, David was a just man. A crime had been committed. It had all the appearances of being a crime of murder. Judgment must be executed upon the murderer. As the head of all justice in the land, the king just can't set aside the penalty just because it's his own favorite son that's the guilty party. That doesn't set the right example. So he couldn't set it aside. At least he didn't think he could. And so he longed after Absalom, but there was nothing he felt he could do. In fact, if you want to analyze the law, it wasn't just a matter that Absalom deserved to be sentenced to death. Stop and think about it for a minute. Who would have been the person to execute that penalty? David himself, because he was nearest of kin to the murdered Amnon. And therefore he was the blood revenger. To make the matter worse, that it would be his responsibility, if he ever saw Absalom, to execute the judgment. That's a pretty hard position to be put in when it was his own favorite son. Now Joab, as we see in chapter 14, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was toward Absalom. He saw the problem. He saw that David was totally distracted from the business of governing the nation because he was pining away over poor Absalom, at least poor Absalom in David's mind. Other people might not have used that expression in describing him. So Joab decides to work this thing out. And he sends to Tekoa and fetches there a wise woman. She indeed was a wise woman. And he says to her, pretend to be a mourner. Put on mourning apparel. Don't anoint yourself with oil. Be as a woman that has for a long time mourned for her dead. And come to the king, in other words, when he sits in his court as the appeals court or the supreme court. I shouldn't use the term appeals court because there were no such things. But as the supreme court of the nation. As he sits there as the highest judge, when difficult cases that could not be resolved at lower levels are brought to his attention, you come in among the plaintiffs and present this case as if it was really your case. You see, what Joab is about, he wants David to look at this case as presented by the widow woman without realizing it has anything to do with Absalom, just to look at the merits of the case and make what to him would be a righteous judgment. And then Joab will point out the points of comparison between this case and Absalom's case, so David could see that he should be able, legally and justifiably, to issue the same judgment in the case of Absalom. And that will solve the problem. In other words, there is evidence in Absalom's situation that justifies a mitigation of the law, of the penalty. There are mitigating circumstances in Absalom's case. And he constructs this woman's case in such a way so the mitigating circumstances of Absalom's case are also in this woman's case. So that David will then be able to see the relationship and say, okay, I'm not just being selfish to set aside the penalty against Absalom. I'm not perverting justice when I do it. I am really using tzedakah, you see, if I do that. So where are the points of comparison? What did you find? Or did you have great difficulty in seeing the points of comparison? Anybody wish to volunteer? No? Absalom was the acknowledged heir to the throne, and this is the case, the surviving son of the woman. You see, this is the point. It's a case, of course, of one brother murdering another brother, which is not really what was meant in the terms of the law as it was first legislated by God. It presupposes, if you read it, that a murder takes place between a man of one family against a man of another family. and how the aggrieved family then is entitled to blood vengeance, as well as a way of punishing the crime of murder. And so part of her case is, you know, is this law, with all its severity, really designed for a case of murder within the family? This is the point she's raising. Especially since, if you then kill this surviving son, how does that bring me comfort? How does that bring me vengeance if I lose the remaining son, you know, in the process? You see, she says, my last remaining coal shall be quenched. And she calls it a coal for a certain reason. What does a coal do once it's put into the fire? What do you do with coal when you put it in the fire? Shows they understood coal and its usages, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. Yes? Okay, provides heat and warmth, right? Now, in what sense is this sun going to provide her warmth and heat? Not physically, of course, that would be incestuous. But in what way would this coal provide her warmth and heat? Hear it? Yeah. If he lives and comes into inheritance of her dead husband's property, then he will provide for her maintenance for the rest of her days, you see. Plus, what else do we have here as a way of providing warmth? In what other sense? Yeah, the family line will continue. You see, her husband's name will not be blotted out in Israel. He will continue a family line. And that way there's warmth. She will have grandchildren, her physical descendants. She will be able to bounce on her knee, you see. And that's not an inconsiderable thing in these days and age. Even today it isn't, but especially back then. That meant something. That's why at the end of the book of Ruth, you know, at the beginning of the book of Ruth, you're introduced to Naomi. She has no husband, she's a widow, and both of her sons are dead. She has no hope of ever seeing physical grandchildren to bounce on her knee. And at the end of the book, what's the last thing practically that you read is how she saw Boaz and Naomi's children and was able to enjoy that relationship, you see. Her future hope of children, grandchildren, was fulfilled. Her barrenness at the beginning is contrasted with the fertility that she achieved through Naomi and Boaz's union at the end. This is a very important consideration in these days. What else is brought out as the woman, by the widow woman, as grounds for, let's say, mitigating circumstances? What does she bring out that she stressed in the case? Did you notice it? Besides the fact that, you know, exercising the penalty would not increase her level of comfort, but rather increase her level of grief, you know, that's a significant factor. She also brings out some mitigating factors here. Okay, when she says her whole family is against her, what relation are these people to her? They're not her brothers. Who are these brothers? They're her dead husband's brothers, who, if they can kill her son, become the heirs, and therefore can enjoy the property. So in other words, she's alleging they're not acting out of interests of justice. They're acting out of personal greed, that if they can destroy my remaining son, therefore, there are no heirs of my body left. There are no heirs of my husband left. They become the heirs to the property. So they really, their motives are not pure in desiring the death of, quote, the murderer. So they are interested parties, you see, not disinterested parties. What else does she mention as a factor that David should weigh? Very important that when they were arguing, there was no intercessor. No one interceded to quiet the argument, pour oil on the waters, to prevent the anger from increasing until it overflowed into an act of murder, in an act of passion. In other words, there's also the implication that somebody could have and should have interceded, but didn't. Do you see the point of contact now with David's situation? Remember, when Absalom killed Amnon, it wasn't the next day after Tamar was raped. It was quite some time afterward. And undoubtedly his anger was inflamed by the fact that David must have heard of the crime that had been committed against Absalom's sister. And David did nothing. He was the intercessor who failed to act. He had failed to perform his role of having exacted a penalty from Amnon and therefore prevented Absalom from boiling over into this act of murder. Not a revenger of blood, because the crime of rape was not considered to be on the same par. But at the same point, you know, rape was considered to be a very serious crime, you see, a very, very serious crime. And therefore, the fact that David had done nothing was a very serious breach in justice. And as I say, if we had more specific case studies in the Bible of how the written laws of God were applied, we could judge this case more adequately than we're able to do. So all we can see is that David could not have acted as he did eventually unless, you know, it was obviously a righteous judgment that he saw that he could make in Absalom's case. So even if we have difficulty in seeing how these circumstances themselves would have merited putting aside the penalty, we just have to accept the fact that that was considered a righteous judgment. And as I say, if we had more comparable material to study, we could see it more clearly. But all we can do is look at this case and see where the points are in the widow's contrived case, which touches upon Absalom's situation. It would have meant doing away with the heir. It would have meant doing away with somebody when the people that were pushing the matter were not doing it in the interest of justice, but because they could advance their own inheritance. That might have applied very clearly to the other sons of David who may have been agitating for Absalom's death, so that one of them would have stood the chance of becoming David's successor. In other words, they just weren't interested in avenging Amnon's blood. They were avenging, you know, they just wanted to increase their own chances of inheriting. And then, of course, it brings out the point that David should have interceded by taking severe action against Amnon for his crime. And by not doing so, he had been a causative factor in the crime that followed. That the case, therefore, was flawed by his inaction. Now notice that David keeps trying to put off the woman. He does not want to personally pronounce a judgment. He wants to leave it up to the judges at a lower level. He says, well, I'll instruct the judges about the peculiar circumstances of your case. I'm sure they will reach a righteous judgment. But that won't serve the purpose. The whole purpose is just like with Nathan. To get David out of his own mouth to pronounce a judgment in a case that does not appear to bear any relationship to anything personal. And then he can see that I'd made that judgment, you know, out of the way God led me to see righteousness. Now I see this could apply to Absalom. I'm not being unfair to apply it. That's why Joab, you know, instructed her very carefully. You keep going at him until he pronounces a judgment. You know, don't let him off. And she keeps pressing him in different ways. And obviously Joab chose very wisely. So this woman goes at it many different ways using a great deal of wisdom. Finally, however, before he actually pronounces a judgment, he begins to see what's afoot. And as he says, how does he put it here? In verse 18, he says, the king answered and said to the woman, don't hide this from me, I pray you, the thing that I'm just about now to ask you. He said, is not the hand of Joab with you in all this? Didn't Joab put you up to this thing? Because it's begun to dawn on David, these many points, that they all apply to his own situation with Absalom. Maybe having been given this treatment by Nathan, his antenna are a little more sensitized now, and he begins slowly, albeit, to notice, you know, this sounds too much like my situation with Absalom to be just the case. I wonder if Joab is behind this, because Joab must have been working on him for a long time beforehand with no effect, getting to him to try to see that, you know, he could cancel the penalty against Absalom, say, no, I can't do that. That wouldn't be fair. I'm supposed to be the fountain of justice in the land. I can't do it. And so he begins to suspect that Joab is the active party. Again, some of you may want to make a careful character study of Joab, because it seems like Joab is a very intensely loyal man. You know, here's David. He's down in the dumps, and he feels badly about it, and he's trying to help David out of this situation. Wow, what a wonderful guy. Study Joab more carefully. You know, sometimes people can be loyal for more than the best reasons, and I think you'll see that that was the case of Joab. Not exactly an admirable person. But anyway, David does see the point, and he does see that he has been wrong in his previous estimation of Absalom's situation, and he brings Absalom back. But, you know, David seems to have had a problem, not just with Absalom, but apparently with his other sons, too. It's apparently, whether because he was so busy fighting wars and running the government or whatever, he never really had a very close personal relationship with any of his sons. Because notice the end of the chapter, when he eventually brings Absalom back, how he treats him. He brings him in, there's a brief greeting. Absalom goes bound to his own house. Absalom was dwelling right in the capital city of Jerusalem, probably in a building very close to the royal palace, since he was of the royal family. And yet for 2 full years, he never was brought into the king's presence. That's not exactly what you call warm. It's no wonder that eventually, I'm not excusing Absalom, but it's not that surprising that eventually Absalom decided to grab the kingdom away from David. And I say David, I think, was partly responsible for that. And maybe that explains why later when Absalom was killed, as a result of his rebellion, that David wept so bitterly over it. It wasn't just that this was his favorite son, but he could see that he himself had been responsible by his cool treatment of Absalom, that he himself was partly, at least, to blame for what Absalom later did. Okay. One other matter we might cover as far as David's domestic policies, and this is where we'll bring these slides into play. One of the most important things that David did in terms of domestic policy was to change the capital. To change the capital from Hebron, where he had ruled when it was just the one kingdom of Judah, to change it to the city of Jerusalem. Now that required a military conquest. Because remember, up until David's day, the city of Jerusalem was still Canaanite, specifically the Jebusites, that branch of the Canaanite family, lived in Jerusalem, and it was an island existing between the two kingdoms. Now, this was really a brilliant stroke. It doesn't say specifically, but I think that God was behind this and God inspired it. It was a brilliant stroke for several reasons. When it was conquered, this was something that all the tribes participated in. So it wasn't something. Once Jerusalem became the capital, no tribe could crow, "The capital is in our tribal territory." You see, it had not been in any of the tribe's territories. It might have technically been assigned to the tribe of Benjamin, but it hadn't really been possessed by them. It came into the possession of Israel as a result of joint enterprise of all the tribes under David's leadership. And so therefore, it was sort of a neutral territory. It was not the property, specifically speaking, of any of the tribes. It sort of reminds me of the case of the United States. Is that when they chose to create a federal district to be known as the city of Washington, they did it by asking the two adjoining states to cede territory from their state to create this neutral federal district. So there wouldn't be a case of jealousy among the various 13 colonies as to which one had the capital. You see. Also, Jerusalem sat right on the border between the two kingdoms. It's interesting that in the case of the United States, and I'm not meaning anything more than the fact that we have an interesting analogy, so please don't read me wrong, that when this nation acquired its federal capital under the Constitution, that Washington, D.C. was located midway between the New England colonies and or states and the most southern state of Georgia at the time. That was one reason why it was located there. They could have asked other states to have ceded the territory, but they wanted to put the capital geographically in the middle so that it would be convenient for all the citizens and people would feel better about it having, you know, geographically mid-distance. It just turns out that Jerusalem is located between the two kingdoms. We're not exactly positive, but there is some indication even in the scripture that perhaps the city was administered almost as a personal property of the royal family, rather than even being considered national property. I wouldn't want to push that point too hard. What you see on the slide, which unfortunately part of it is off, we can't help that, is the present-day old city of Jerusalem. Okay, thank you. Now we have much better, thank you. You can see the walls around the present-day old city.
It's really very tiny. This is another thing that people realize when they go over and actually visit the place, is how tiny the city is within the walls. At its greatest extent from east to west, if you take the widest point, it's just about a kilometer, 0.6 miles. And at its greatest extent from north to south, it's again about a kilometer, 0.6 miles. Really very tiny place. But the original city that David conquered was only this thing down here. It's called, on the map, Ancient City of David. It wasn't even inside what's now the walled city. 12.5 acres. Estimated population of perhaps 2,000 people. That was the Jebusite city that David conquered. Here we have that same area. And it's located on the southeastern slopes of what is now the city of Jerusalem. The reason for its location being there is it was near the only real good supply of water, the Gihon Spring. The Gihon Spring. Gihon means the dragon spring, so-called because of its peculiar pattern, is that in the summertime twice a day and in the winter 5 times a day, it suddenly gushes extra amounts of water. And interestingly enough, from its current outside entrance, which is modern, you have the spring chamber. You can proceed up it, and you find this vertical shaft and then a sort of sloping horizontal tunnel. The original city wall, as you can see, was here. The sloping tunnel actually went outside the wall, underneath it, I should say, and then you had this steep vertical shaft of about 75 feet for which people could let down their buckets and pull up water. This might be, notice I say might, because this thing is heavily in dispute, the Tsinor, which is mentioned in the Bible, because in connection with the capture of Jerusalem, it mentions that David was taunted by the people of Jerusalem, saying, look, even our blind people and our lame people could keep you out. And so David said to his people, he said, look, who will go up there and smite these people who have insulted me in such a rich fashion? He shall be commander-in-chief of the armies. And it says that Joab accepted the challenge, and by way of the Tsinor, he gained access to the city. Now, the word Tsinor does not appear anywhere else that I know of in the Bible. And so, therefore, we don't have other context to judge what the word means. It's not a word in common Hebrew usage even today. And so there's a big debate about what that word means. It might have meant this vertical shaft. Being 75 feet, the Jebusites might have thought nobody could successfully climb up it and gain entrance to the city behind the wall. But it is possible. It has been suggested that that's what Joab climbed up. Here you see somebody climbing up that shaft, but of course he's using some modern assistance in the form of ropes. Okay. David's international policy was one of expansion and conquest. Here you see on this map the areas that he subdued and placed under Israelite rule. You can see that as a result of this expansion, David acquired full control of all the major land trade routes that ran through this region of Palestine on both sides of the Jordan. You can see the King's Highway starting down there from the Red Sea, running up through all the kingdoms on the east bank of the Jordan, all the way to Damascus. You can see the Via Maris running through there. All of these areas became subjugated. Now, what I have done is to prepare a chart that explains how and when these different kingdoms came under David's control. Some of the details are provided in that summary chapter of David's reign, 2 Samuel chapter 8, but not all of the details. Now, I will hold you responsible for this information, hint, 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 but therefore, you should check the scriptures to see how these different confrontations led to David acquiring additional territory. What I've tried to give is the particular enemy nation in one column, the biblical sources where the wars against them are mentioned, and the apparent or given reason for why David militarily took action against each of these foreign powers. Some cases the Bible specifically tells us why. Other cases we have to possibly construe a reason. And then the last column gives the ultimate result. Because David did not rule all of these areas in exactly the same way. The areas that you see in the dark color were all inhabited by the tribes. But he did not treat the Philistines when he conquered them in the same way that he treated Edom or Moab or Ammon. There was a difference in how he treated these different areas. In fact, you will find that David changed the double kingdom of Judah and Israel into a triple kingdom. He ruled one of these conquered territories as their native king. He actually assumed the title of king of one of these conquered areas. If you're not familiar with which one, you'll be reading the scriptures in connection with the chart, you'll find out. In other cases, he appointed a governor to administer the area. And in one other case, he actually allowed somebody of the local royal family to rule as his vassal. Now, why he used different techniques in different places, we have to speculate more about as to why that was the case. We can't say, you know, with specifics, because the Bible just doesn't tell us. So if you have any questions after you have worked with this on Wednesday, you can bring them up in class, and we'll entertain a few of those questions before we talk about Solomon's kingdom, which, of course, rested on the foundation of David's conquest.